Welcome to the Not All Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today on the Not All Better Show is Rear Admiral Michael Georgione, who served a total of 29 years on active duty in the United States Navy. He has served as the commander of Camp David for President Bill Clinton and President George W. Bush, and has written a new book about the Camp David experience titled Inside Camp David, The Private World of the Presidential Retreat. Admiral Georgione will be presenting stories from the book and other Camp David insights at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C., January 23, 2018. More information is available at our website. Of course, the question on everyone's mind is, what's it like? What are the challenges working there? And how do you live in the world of the president at Camp David?
Undoubtedly, what I found to be the greatest leadership challenge living and working at Camp David was the sense that you had to be perfect but natural. Perfect but natural. The place always had to be ready to receive the president, the grounds perfect, the plumbing perfect, everything well done, but looking natural, so that nature did not have that scrubbed look, but a natural look. And that was one of the greatest challenges in not only living there, but working there and leading the crew. From doing the research on the book and knowing and talking with other commanding officers through the history of Camp David, we all agreed that it was an incredible honor to be in the world, but not of the world of the president. And that was one of the things we had to always remember. We are briefly in their world, but not of their world.
That, of course, is our guest today, Admiral Georgione, who is currently a much sought-after speaker and educator throughout the United States and the world, and is joining us today via Skype.
Well, Admiral Michael Georgione, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. Great to be here with you and your listeners.
Great. Well, I will call you Mike throughout the interview. I think that's going to be helpful to me, maybe, and maybe easier on everybody's ears. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking.
Of course. Well, the book, Inside Camp David, is a compilation, really. And my point there is that you did this with about 15 other commanding officers. Tell us about the term commanding officer, and over what period of time does the book cover?
The book covers the 75-year history of Camp David, which was last year, 2017, President Roosevelt opening it officially in July of 1942. As I put the book together and certainly had my rich experiences, I realized a greater historical narrative, discussion of the stories, the insights, the emotions would be benefited by interviewing all the other commanding officers who I've known for years or met recently. And that was part of the biggest part of the research of the project, was calling and talking and taping and following up with every CO, commanding officer of the command. Camp David is officially a Navy activity. Its official name is Naval Activity Facility, Thurmont, Maryland. Because it's a Navy command, we have an officer that's in charge, or the commanding officer. That's why it's considered a Navy command. That's why we use that term, CO, or commanding officer.
Well, you write in the book, Inside Camp David, that there's a small staff present there, and specifically that you and the staff are privy to a hidden side of the U.S. presidency. I think my audience are going to be very curious about that. So what do you mean by it, and what might we learn from reading the book? It's a little voyeuristic.
Yes, and there is certainly a balance in the book. I certainly wasn't going to share any of the really private moments. That would be, I think, disrespectful. But I wanted America and others to understand the rich history and the purpose of Camp David, which I really go into in Chapter 12, The True Meaning of Camp David. What most reviewers have told me who have looked at the book, they appreciate greatly the personalization I give to the presidents and their family. And I think that's where I go with showing the private side, that they like to relax. They need to relax, just like you and me. They like to eat a cheeseburger. They like to go for a walk. They may want to work out. They may want to watch TV, and they do a lot of work as well. It's like you and I, quote unquote, again, of their world, not in their of their world, but in their world. And seeing that and realizing it day to day on the weekend was very humbling. It's, of course, realistic. They're human like you and I are. But to see it in action is almost a surreal realization of what they must deal with when they go back to the White House and do the business of the world, business of the nation. And it gave me a very interesting perspective to the burdens, the challenges, and what they need when they come to Camp David, which our mission is to give them that rest and relaxation over that weekend and support them to the best of our ability.
It's really a retreat that sits on federal land. So tell us a little bit about the property.
The property was found by Roosevelt's staff in the 40s. It was an old Conservation Corps camp, Civilian Conservation Corps, part one of the many programs of the New Deal. Roosevelt said, I can't go out on my presidential yacht anymore because of aerial threats and water threats during the early war years. So they found several camps nearby that he could drive through to, and this was the one he chose in Thurmont, Maryland, in the Catawkin National Park, about an elevation of 1,800 feet. It is on federal land. It's about 200 acres. It was ceded to the White House back in 1942, and it's been under their auspices through the White House Military Office, my chain of command, since 1942.
The name Camp David is from President Eisenhower, I believe. What does that refer to?
Roosevelt first visited camp in July of 1942, as I said. He, in his true subtle humor, he called it his Shangri-La. He stated, I have found my Shangri-La, referring to the novel Lost Horizon by John Upton, in that mystical, out-of-the-way, mysterious place. So the name was originally Shangri-La. President Truman did not change the name. President Eisenhower came into office, considered closing Camp David, thought it was unnecessary, especially with his farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, was convinced by his staff that it maybe would have a purpose, but he didn't like the name. He thought it was a little pretentious. So he named it Camp David after his grandson, David Eisenhower.
Have there been any political moves to kind of shut this camp down?
Only in the sense of a president thinking it wasn't necessary, such as I said about President Eisenhower. President Carter also thought it maybe it wasn't something he needed coming into his presidency. He was taking that very humble farmer approach to things and things he did in the White House with lighting and things as such, and it kind of transferred to maybe his curiosity or doubts about Camp David. He, in fact, though, made it probably the most famous with the 1978 Camp David Peace Accords, and that was attributed mostly to his wife, Rosalind, and she convincing him that maybe this was the best place to bring Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin to have your very intense and personal conversations. So Eisenhower maybe thought about it, Carter maybe thought about it, but since then, I think no one's really made a political or administrative move to close it, but each president has discovered its meaning and purpose for them, whether it's personal or diplomatic.
I read that President George H.W. Bush was known to employ humor sometimes in his notes about camp concerns, and he wrote once to another Mike, Commander Mike Berry, about the toilet in the presidential bathroom. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
The presidential toilet. President George H.W. Bush had incredible humor and great camaraderie with the crew. And through the purpose and the process of interviewing his other commanding officers, as I said earlier, what a rich bevy of stories to share. And Mike Berry would oftentimes receive these personal notes. And one time, probably due to a backup in the toilet in Aspen, the president's lodge, he wrote a very humorous but obviously pointed note about fixing it, but done in a very subtle, humorous way that I know the crew, including the CO, really appreciated the way carried about his business.
So some presidents have used Camp David maybe more than others. It appears maybe that President Trump may prefer his Mar-a-Lago Palm Beach resort over Camp David, but he's been there too. What do you think presidents really like so much about Camp David?
President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan used it the most of any president. It was undoubtedly their place to get away, and they went there almost every weekend during his 8 years in office. They rarely had guests. Occasionally, Margaret Thatcher visited twice, in fact, but rarely had guests. They use it as their personal retreat. He also used it for Saturday radio addresses. That's the extreme, I think, where someone uses it just to get away. Most other presidents have had a balance. President Obama didn't use it a lot, but he did some very historic things there by bringing the Jade Summit there, for example, the Gulf Cooperation Council for there. President Bush during my time, President Clinton during my time, had a nice balance of personal weekends with family and friends, as well as diplomatic weekends with foreign leaders. President Trump, I opined in a recent op-ed piece in Parade.com that It may not be his Mar-a-Lago, certainly is intended to be, but I do think there's a great purpose in Camp David for the diplomatic or administrative use. And I was very encouraged by his recent weekend with Republican leadership and bringing his cabinet there twice before, that I think, I hope, I expect he's going to discover the beauty, the serenity, the purpose of going to camp with his staff and foreign leaders, at least, to discuss things. He hasn't yet brought an international leader there. I predict that that happens in some near future.
Yeah, and historically, it's really been a place of real public policy importance. You mentioned the Mideast peace proposals that were discussed there, but also through your eyes and others, it's a real place that humanizes world leaders. Which story about all these leaders as people impresses you most?
The one, of course, I didn't witness, but when you read about Roosevelt and Churchill going out to a nearby creek and fishing and smoking cigars and drinking, you know, having a drink together and making comments like, you know, it really is really easier to do business when you get to know someone. It's so obvious to you and me, but sometimes we don't think in the context that our president and other world leaders do that. Firsthand, two examples. I saw President Clinton working, of course, very intently, very passionately during the Middle East Peace Summit of 2000. And when I saw him go to the cabin with Yasser Arafat and go to Prime Minister Ehud Barak's cabin and just personally roll up his sleeves and get very intensely involved in what I viewed from the sidelines as really working the personalities and the egos, the fears and anxieties of these leaders, I realized, you know, leadership is about that. You have to make that very personal connection with other people. And I saw it firsthand, again, from the sidelines with him. Similarly, President Bush, after coming into office, his very first foreign leader guest was Prime Minister Tony Blair and his wife at Camp David. And that weekend, just he and Laura Bush hosted the Blairs. So just two couples, no staff. It was a lighter time in the world. This is before 9/11. This is February of 2001. And so they had one very lighthearted press conference off the mountain. But to watch again from the sidelines, our president building a relationship with the Prime Minister of Britain, who he had never met, and certainly there are different political ideologies, but coming together with our greatest ally and building the relationship early was very impressive to me.
Well, Michael Giorgione, I have one final question for you, maybe another funny story that I certainly laughed out loud at, and that's the story of Brezhnev and Nixon in the Lincoln.
Yes.
If you could just leave us with that, maybe that'll be a nice way to conclude.
So you're hosting, you know, the Soviet Union premier, and you realize he likes Lincoln Continentals, and so your staff give him a gift at Camp David of a nice car. And these are some of those things that happen at camp that even for a president you don't expect. So Brezhnev motioned to Nixon to get into the passenger seat because he wanted to drive it, and off they went. No security detail, no one following because it was very spontaneous, apparently. And they went down one of the perimeter roads, which is a large hill, and Nixon wrote that he had great fear that he was not going to be able to negotiate that hairpin turn, which he did. So brakes squealing, I'm sure white-knuckled president and premier holding on to the steering wheel and the door handle, and there was no incident. But those little humanistic, unexpected, spontaneous moments that I found to exist all the time during my time at Camp David as well.
What a wonderful story that is. That just brings so many images to mind. I loved hearing that from you. And all the rest, too. Admiral Michael Giorgione, of course, author of the new book, Inside Camp David, The Private World of the Presidential Retreat. Michael Giorgione, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
And best wishes to all our listeners.
Thank you very much. My thanks to our guest today, Admiral Michael Giorgione, who will be presenting stories from the book Inside Camp David, The Private World of the Presidential Retreat at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C., January 23rd, 2018. Admiral Giorgione's book will be available for purchase and signing following the presentation. More information is available at our website. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our wonderful interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything. And also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notold-better.com. That's info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all, and remember, offer some kindness, service, and love to everyone you meet. You'll never regret it, and you'll make a difference. Thanks, everybody.